Zelensky had an interview with Fox News in which he said that nobody needs Avdiivka. If that was the case, why they resisted too much to give it to Russians?
Yeah, the real good question. And the answer is they insisted they needed it. It was a critical logistics hub in terms of where the railroads would come in. They'd be able to offload supplies, load up wounded. It was a important juncture. Losing it has really broken up their front defensive line. So he's lying, making excuses. There's no other way to look at it.
When you look at this fight in Avdiivka, how did you find it in terms of their casualty on the Ukrainian side?
Well, they took enormous casualties because they're in a static position and they're getting hit with 500 kilogram bombs, 1,500 kilogram bombs. So that's, anywhere from 1,000 to 3,000 pound bombs. Those are devastating. Apart from the blast effect, the concussive effect, when you're getting hit with that, the concussive wave, that causes injury, wounding soldiers, not just the effects of fire and blast.
Danish government declared that they're going to send F-16s to Ukraine. Do you think that it's going to be the same for other countries? Are they going to send F-16s to Ukraine? This is the beginning of this act.
If they do it, it does run the risk of Russia finally saying, okay, we've, being fed up, we've had enough. We're not going to sit back and allow these continued provocations from the West to attack our people, our civilians, and we will respond without doing anything. The reality with even the F-16, it's not going to change the situation on the battlefield. Period. This is the era of the F-16 is over. It's a dinosaur. It's no longer really a relevant combat airframe in light of the development of unmanned aerial vehicles and drones and other advances in ISR platforms, coupled with air defense systems, which can really reach out and touch somebody at distances that previously were unimaginable. So, just shake your head at the foolishness. You think that these people, because they're top government officials, would have a measure of intelligence and competence, but they don't. They're fools, simplest way to put it.
If you remember, the advisor of Zelensky said that Ukraine has no backup plan. Just 2 days ago, Zelensky repeated the same sentence. He said that we don't have a plan B. Who's going to force them to have a plan B? Because this way that the war is going, it doesn't seem that they're going to win. They're going to change the battlefield.
Well, if you have a you're talking a contingency plan. And that's assuming that there was a logical planning process that was done, that they sat back and said, okay, here's our optimal plan A. If that fails, here's our plan B. If that fails, here's our plan C. You prepare for a variety of contingencies. You go always with the hope that the optimal one achieves success, but you have to be prepared for the failure. The fact that they don't have a plan B or a plan C is just a reflection of both the incompetence of Ukrainian and Western planners, number one, the arrogance that possessed them at the outset, where they assumed that they were dealing with a Russian military that was weak and would collapse with just a little bit of pressure. And reality is intruded. Even if they come up with another alternative plan, they can't do anything to implement it. They don't have the soldiers. I keep repeating that over and over and over, but they don't have the soldiers. They don't have the soldiers. They don't have the soldiers. They are not going to you can't just wave a magic wand and these people spring out of the dirt. They have to be born, raised, and then they have to be recruited and trained. And the training to turn out competent. When I talk about a competent combat soldier, I'm talking about somebody that at least understands basic orders, can handle, you know, basic communications and can maneuver in concert with other forces on the battlefield. That takes, you know, from the time they're enlisted, you know, you're realistically talking about a year-long period, if not more, in order to achieve that kind of training proficiency. Ukraine doesn't have that. Hell, they didn't even do it last year during their preparation for the counteroffensive, and the West certainly didn't encourage them to achieve that level of competence. So they're playing, well, you know, they think this is, I guess, one of those video games, like, you know, you play the war game on video, and then you can always use some cheat codes to recreate, you know, come back to life. This is not a video game.
They're using women in this battle for, and it's so, when you look at the picture, it's unbelievable what's happening right now.
Actually, it's not unbelievable at all. It's quite believable. They have run out of the normal guys that you would recruit into the military, like kids between the ages of 18, 21, 22. They are having to rely upon men who's at the average age of 43. And they're bringing in women, including pregnant women. The reality is women are not as good as soldiers as men. They lack the physical strength that men do. They can't fight like men do. Some can. You know, once in a while, you can find an there's always exceptions to the rules. But across the board, on average, the average woman doesn't match up. You call it one of the signs with mothers of new sons and new daughters. You're putting them out into battle to become cannon fodder, where, you know, they're killed again. It's a way for a society to kill itself, and which is exactly what these Ukrainian folks are doing. They're killing themselves.
Do you see Biden changing his attitude toward Ukraine?
No. Ukraine is doing its best to produce propaganda news every day about, oh man, we're killing Russians here, killing Russians there, shooting down planes here. Okay. To indulge these fantasies for as long as you can. But just as we saw with Avdiivka, oh yeah, no, we're not, we've got a firm hold on it. We're defending it. They're forced out. Russia has stepped up its pressure all across the line. We're really about 2 weeks away from what they call the Rasputitsa, where the terrain turns back into a big mud bath, and the ability of the various forces to move. So then at that point, it's who's got the long-range artillery, who's got the long-range missiles, who's got the combat air that can deliver glide bombs from a distance. And Russia has the advantage on all those fronts. Ukraine doesn't. So it will continue to be a target and continue to suffer casualties.
We know that Europeans recently were talking about war economy. How they can do this?
Yeah, they can't. Look, they've embraced the woke green agenda. The green agenda is predicated upon this nonsense that the worst offender in terms of contributing to the warming of the planet are the human beings who are using fossil fuels. Therefore, the solution is start a reduction in the use of fossil fuels and maybe, if necessary, eliminate some of those human beings, which is effectively what's being done in the war in Ukraine. Russia's doing a real good job of eliminating Ukrainians. But, you know, then in their embrace of this green ideology, they've gotten rid of nuclear plants. They've gotten rid of coal fire plants, gotten rid of steel industry. So all of a sudden, these heavy industries, which are needed to produce steel, to produce weapons, to produce, on top of that, computer chips, drones, tanks, they're going away. They're not building more, they're building less. They're not diminishing obstacles to their creation, they're increasing them. So it's like they haven't awakened to the fact that they've got to make sure that the rhetoric, what they're saying today, matches what they're doing in terms of actual economic policy. So, you know, they can talk about shifting to a war footing all they want. They're not They're not ever going to get there.
Lavrov said that if we're going to get a new member to the UN Security Council, it's going to be from Africa, Asia, or Latin America. In your opinion, how we can have some sort of balance?
Apart from Russia, the balance of the majority of the Security Council with veto power are the old colonial empire. France, United Kingdom, United States. I mean, they rose up out of World War II as the ones left standing and imposed. It was the U.S. imposing its will, letting France and the U.K. come in based upon an ancient colonial legacy, because the reality was neither country's anything approximating a superpower. Then you've got Russia and China. So, you know, those five countries constitute the core of the UN Security Council. China was brought in because of, it fighting with the West and against Japan during World War II. Now, they're, the world's changed. Okay, it's the United States, one country from Europe, but someone appointed by the European Union, not necessarily from France or Britain, but only one country out of Europe, one country out of Southeast Asia, most likely that would be India. You could also make a case for Indonesia. Keep China, one country out of South America, Brazil, so you go with those countries. And then South in Africa, you got a variety of choices, because Africa is such a diverse continent. When you start with Egypt and Algeria in the north, they're normally not viewed as African nations. They're viewed as sort of Middle East, Mediterranean states. Then you get down to Nigeria, which is arguably probably the most populous country in Africa, or South Africa, again, with its colonial legacy, but having risen above that to become a predominantly black country ruled by black-skinned people. So, the current world order is not working to serve world order. It's working to serve very narrow colonial interests. Those still remain an interference in the affairs of nations.
Mainstream media is talking about that we had stalemate in Ukraine.
What happened to that stalemate? Yeah, geez. Yeah, the media is not an honest, objective, thoughtful enterprise anymore. They're dishonest, and they cater to whatever the political wind, whichever direction the political wind is blowing at the moment. So before the narrative, stalemate, stalemate, stalemate. Well, you can go back and watch the tapes. I was saying, that's nonsense. It's not a stalemate. I mean, good God. Or if it is a stalemate, they're making up a new definition. It has nothing to do with two opposing forces that are now have reached a point of equilibrium where one cannot change the situation for the other. I mean, that's just ridiculous. Russia retained a decisive edge, and that's now on display. And it's going to continue to be on display all along that 1,000, 1,200 kilometer line of contact from north to south. They're sort of controlling the narrative now.
Is Russia going to pass the Dnieper River?
I don't think so. Or at least they will cross the Dnieper to take Kiev. But beyond that, I think they use the Dnieper as the dividing line. Everything to the west of the Dnieper will belong to Ukraine or the West. And what Russia is going to insist on is a buffer zone, so that its people can no longer be faced with these terrorist bombings with artillery and drone attacks from the West. But again, they're not intent on occupying and controlling in the western part of Ukraine. I think they see this too much of a headache. But there are enough other ethnic groups scattered about the region, you know, Hungarian, Romanian, that and Polish, that, you know, those three countries could find themselves in a scramble to recover some of their old lost territory. So Ukraine is going to be, it's a devastation for Ukraine. But, you know, go back 100 years, find a map with the country of Ukraine on it. You can't, because it didn't exist. It's an artificial creation. It's not a historical reality. These people ethnically, linguistically, have always have been tied to Russia for over, you know, 1,200 years.
How do you find the whole situation right now around this case of Navalny?
So Navalny was simply a tool of Western intelligence that the West tried to use him as a narrative about political opponents of Vladimir Putin being persecuted and poisoned and attacked and drugged and et cetera, that he represented a legitimate voice of alternatives in Russia. Well, let's start with what he was. He was a racist. He called Muslims cockroaches. He's on videotape with it. Okay? So you got to first ask your question, why in the hell are Western leaders embracing a guy who's so virulently anti-Muslim? That, you know, normally that they would be persecuting somebody like that, wanting to have him jailed. But no. He's now the American hero, and the British hero, and the French hero, and the German hero. And he's a racist. That's number one. Number two, he never had widespread popular support in Russia. What did he believe? What were his political views? Did he write them out? Did he express his positions on issues of the day throughout time? Like, you go to my blog, Sonar21, you can see that I've got a pretty long track record of commenting on issues. You will understand what my point of view is, what my political perspective is. He didn't have that. Navalny did not have that. So you got to ask yourself, well, on what basis is he a political figure? Because the only way you do this is like what we're doing now. I get on, I talk to you, I'm interviewed, I speak, people listen, or I write and people read what I write. There's no other magic way. I haven't, you know, perfected the, you know, Star Trek mind meld where I could, you know, send my thoughts to you and control your thoughts or something like, you know, I guess that's out of Star Wars too. You know, you've got to have a way to establish your presence. So that's number one. Navalny, he was a fraud, basically. And he was jailed in part because of his fraudulent activities. He was selected by the West, cultivated by Western intelligence. There are clear ties, circumstantial evidence linking him both to the CIA and to British MI6. The real odd thing is his wife, as you pointed out, the Navalny's mom came out yesterday and goes, wait a second, this bitch is a gold digger. You know, she talked my son into coming back to Russia 2 years ago when if he was smart, he would have stayed out. She had him sign over all of his property to her. And then while he was in jail for 2 years, she never went to visit him and said she's out running around with other guys, you know, sleeping with them. And then on the day he dies, wonder of wonder, miracle of miracles, she shows up at the Munich Security Conference, and oh, lo and behold, her husband's dead, and she gets to mourn. And she's a terrible actress. You know, she was really not that distraught about it. Oh, yeah, it's awful. Oh, starting to count the money up. Cha-ching. So, but then you come back and say, what is the real issue here? Is this an issue of that according to the rules-based international order, all governments are obligated to speak out on behalf of political dissidents who are being persecuted and prosecuted by their governments. Well, if that's the fact, why didn't they say a damn word about Gonzalo Lira when Gonzalo Lira was murdered, when he was killed by the prison system in Ukraine? Not a word. What about Julian Assange? Not a word. It comes up to the protests. Hey, in the United States, we don't have one Navalny in jail. We got almost 1,200 protesters, U.S. citizens, who were arrested for the alleged crime of stirring up either insurrection or confronting, attacking Capitol Hill police. Well, they didn't do any of that. Over 95% of those that have been arrested did not assault anybody. They didn't lay hands on. They walked into the Capitol. They were peaceful. They protested, as is the right under the Constitution. And the Biden administration weaponized it, and not just against these Trump supporters, but against Donald Trump himself. Now the word is, hey, America, look in the mirror, check into your own house. The advice of Jesus was correct. Let those who are without sin cast the first stone. You guys live in a glass house. America lives in a glass house, has no business throwing rocks at anyone else.
We know that a very important portion of the Russian population is coming from the Dagestan, is coming from Chechnya. These are mostly Muslims.
So let's start with the understanding that one of the objectives of Western intelligence is to destroy Russia. And they view one of the weak points of Russia is that because it is such a diverse ethnic collection, it is not Russian ethnically per se. And there are, as you know, Dagestanis and the different races and religions that are represented in Russia. What is particularly noteworthy is how loyal the Chechen Muslims are now to Russia compared to the situation 20 years ago. 20 years ago, the Islamic extremism that was being advocated by the likes of Osama bin Laden and seen coming out of Pakistan and up into Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and filtered up into the Chechen areas, it represented a legitimate threat to the Russian people and was responsible for horrific terrorist attack. Yeah, so remember back, it was in November, I believe, of 2002, this group of Chechen Muslims attacked a school, and they killed over 600 people, 600 children. Then there was an attack in a movie theater. I mean, you had some major significant Muslim terrorist attacks. You would think that because Russia then was facing this wave of radical Islamists attacking it, that there would have been a natural alliance with the United States, who claimed that we're fighting a war on international terrorism caused by Islamists. But there wasn't. You know, we just left that's a Russian problem. So the Russians fought the Chechens, and it was a brutal war. And it went on, I think, until 2009, from roughly 10 years, roughly 1999 to 2009. But the Russians prevailed. And then, remember, the Russians picked up intelligence about those two Chechen boys, the Tsarnaev brothers, tried to warn the FBI about the Tsarnaevs. FBI ignored the warning. Tsarnaevs carried out the Boston Marathon bombing and killed several. But here, Russia achieved this victory over these Chechen extremists and then rebuilt the cities. And the only way I can describe it is the affection and the love expressed by these Muslim soldiers for the country, the Russia motherland, and for Vladimir Putin. It's really remarkable. This is not contrived. This is not something that they're getting paid off to do this. If you want to talk about one gift that Russia could contribute to the world, is to show that it's figured out a way that it can bring all these diverse religious views together in a way that shows respect to each and every one, even though Russia is predominantly a Christian nation by its history. And the influence of the Russian Orthodox Church is terrific. It's widespread. Nonetheless, they still have the respect of these other religious organizations and nationalities. It's really something to behold. So Russia has set a model that the rest of the world, I think, would be wise to follow, but he couldn't get that in the United States. They prefer to have their cartoon version of Russia is an authoritarian, godless state of commies.
The mainstream media is talking about that Biden doesn't want Ukraine to win. How do you find this statement?
Ukraine exists primarily for one purpose, to justify an expanded U.S. defense budget and to justify spending billions of dollars to build new weapon systems that will then be sold to all these allies overseas. The problem is that the war in Ukraine, the special military operation, as the Russians call it, has really exposed the deficits and deficiencies in Western weaponry, and exposed the fact that neither the United States nor Europe is prepared. They lack the industrial base to fight the kind of war that Ukraine and Russia have been fighting for the last 2 years. Ukraine's only been kept in the fight because of this unparalleled financial support that the West has been pouring into it. If left to their own device, they'd be dead. In contrast, Russia stood up and fought not just Ukraine, but the West and beaten them, and is beating them.
If something happened between Europe and Russia, is that possible in your opinion in the first place? If that happens, what would be the consequences for Europe?
You mean relying on Great Britain? Hell, okay. You know, their ship, their submarine the other day had the equivalent of what I guess they'd call it premature ejaculation. You know, they had they fired off a missile and it goes flop. You know, or let's call it ejectile dysfunction. You know. they got to find a form of military Viagra to get their missile out of their silo. You know, the UK's primary platform for delivering nuclear tip missiles to the enemy, which would be Russia, is via these submarines. And now, not only could the submarine not deliver, you know, it failed in its test, but you know, remember about a month ago, The Brits were advertising on LinkedIn, a social media platform for we're looking for an admiral to come command our submarine fleet, because basically all of our officers, current officers, are crap. You know, they couldn't organize a 3-rowboat flotilla. So yeah, please apply. The aircraft carrier, HMS Prince of Wales, was supposed to sail out and lead a NATO exercise two weeks ago. Whoops, broke, can't leave port, joins its sister ship, the Queen Elizabeth, also another broke aircraft carrier. The British are not able to sustain the presence. They've had problems with several of their ships. The two other classy commanders ran into each other running, these missile boats in Oman, in the Persian Gulf. They're a joke. It is as if Monty Python has taken over the Navy and that everything that's being done now is a comedy skit. I mean, it's amazing. You used to think that the Brits were competent. I had my old boss at Department of State. He would be served with the U.S. Marine Corps. He was a colonel when he retired, crusty old guy. And his favorite expression was, they couldn't pour piss out of a boot if you had the instructions written on the heel. And, you know, think about that. You take a boot. Well, if you got to read the instructions, you're going to have to turn it upside down. And he said, basically, the Brits couldn't even accomplish that.
When you look at the situation right now in the Red Sea, how successful was this operation on the part of the United States and United Kingdom to control Houthis?
It's a failure. They haven't controlled Houthis. You know, the Houthis, they shot down their second Predator drone just the other day. They've hit and sunk at least 3 British ships. They hit another ship today. So, and the United States and Britain keep bombing away on the mainland. And, you know, the Houthis keep escaping the bombs. And, you know, so this tit for tat keeps going on, which means the Houthis are the only ones right now actually fighting back on behalf of the Palestinian people. But as far as U.S. and British operational success goes, what a joke. You know, it's embarrassing. You know, they've actually, what the Houthis are exposing is the limitations of the power of the so-called superpower of the United States.
How long they can stay in the Red Sea, and how viable is this decision to stay there?
What year is this now? 2024? I think they're good to at least 2060. They're going to be there and intact long after Joe Biden is gone. Because that's not saying much. He's so old and so decrepit, he could be gone next week. But the reality is the Houthis are not on the verge of being defeated at all. And it's just exposing the weakness of the United States.
When you look at the Biden administration and their attitude toward this war in Ukraine, the first question that comes to mind, what's in it for the Biden administration and why they're so obsessed with this conflict?
They clearly were economically compromised in Ukraine. I mean, this goes back to Joe Biden in 2014 being basically put in charge of Ukraine by Obama. And he then immediately proceeded to interfere with domestic criminal investigations in Ukraine and to get his son on the board of Burisma and to get money that was flowing from Ukrainian oligarchs, get that money into the hands of, you know, Biden family members. They spread the wealth around. You know, a lot of the money went to the Clinton Foundation, too. Some of the money went to the children of Mitt Romney and John Kerry. You know, hey, all the members of Congress can play. So this is a corrupt enterprise. They grossly miscalculated. Remember, the reason to go after Russia, the reason the hatred of Vladimir Putin primarily is because Putin disrupted Western plans to seize and control Russia's assets by using oligarchs and business relationships those oligarchs formed with members of the West, with the Western oligarchs. Putin disrupted that plan. And by God, when he did that, pissed them off something fierce. And he's going to have to pay for it. At least that's their thinking. They've now gotten into a fight they can't win. And it's the hubris and the arrogance on the part of the West to think that they've always denigrated Russian military capabilities and denigrated Vladimir Putin's political skills. So it's blowing up in our face, as well as should.
Shifting the gear to the conflict in Gaza, we had Lula talking about this conflict, and Benjamin Netanyahu didn't like it.
Lula's comment equating what the Israelis are doing to what the Nazis doing to the Gazans and the Palestinians was on par with what the Nazis did to the Jews. And, you know, Netanyahu took great out. Oh, how dare you disgrace the memory of the Holocaust? Well, I wrote a piece at Sonar 21 saying Lula was right. You know, you have to, you know, most people are just absolutely ignorant when it comes to the subject of the Holocaust. Or they have such a skewed vision of it. And a lot of times, you know, there is a big contingent of people who run around saying the Holocaust never happened, or it was a contrived fraud by the Jews. No, it wasn't. You know, when you go back and look at the passage of the Nuremberg Laws in, you know, 1936, I believe it was, then the where it became illegal for a German to marry a Jew, to have any kind of intercourse with a Jew, to have him both sexual or commercial. You know, you had to isolate him. So it was a deliberate persecution of Jews. And then the attack, the Kristallnacht attacks, where the Jewish businesses were destroyed. And then when you got, when the, they moved into Poland, attacking Poland with Operation Barbarossa, or excuse me, with the launch of the war, I guess that was Barbarossa, and they sent out the Einsatzgruppen, rounded up Jews. They rounded up others too, but they were targeting Jews, and it wasn't like they're just targeting Jewish leaders; they're targeting the average Jewish peasant living in a shtetl. And then they were, you know, marched into mass graves, shot, you know, murdered, later rounded up, put into ghettos, and then put into death camps in Poland and concentration camps in Germany. Well, look at what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinians. The Palestinians live in the equivalent of an outdoor of the largest ghetto that has ever existed, Gaza. It is surrounded, they're walled in. Just like the Germans walled in the Jews, put them in a specific area, walled them in. The Jews were not allowed to leave, enter and leave at will. They had to enter and leave at the permission of German guards, just as Palestinians enter and leave at the permission of Israeli guards. They put all sorts of security systems to monitor it. They controlled the food that was going in, which is exactly what's happening to the people in Gaza these days, with Israeli settlers actively blocking the arrival of those food supplies. So the real parallel I see with the Nazi treatment of Jews is with what the Nazis did when they put Jews into the ghettos. You know, Warsaw was the most famous, Lodz ghetto as well, Krakow. But these ghettos were designed to isolate, separate, control, and ultimately kill. And that's exactly what the Israelis are doing right now. It's one thing, you know, if they go back and take the Israeli justification for starting it. We were attacked on October 7th, you know, cue the crocodile tears. They raped us. Okay, good. What are you going to do about it? Are you going to find those who organized it, planned it, carried it out, and attack them, kill them, force them to be arrested, force them to be isolated? Oh, no, 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 no. We're going to punish every single Palestinian, man, woman, child, old, young, killing babies. And they're killing babies to justify it because, well, they killed our babies. Well, actually, we've yet to see a list of the names of those babies that Hamas allegedly killed, because it's a lie, a damned lie. Hamas didn't kill a bunch of Israeli children on October 7th. In fact, the evidence clearly shows the Israeli children had died in some of the kibbutzes, who died at the hand of the Israeli soldiers who were recklessly firing without regard to the presence of Israeli civilians in some of these homes that were held by Hamas fighters. So Yeah, Lula is right. Israel's acting like a bunch of Nazis, talking like Nazis. Yeah, you know, if the swastika fits, wear it.
It seems that the King of Jordan was giving a message from the Arab world to Biden. How do you find the next step of the Biden administration?
They don't care. They don't care what the Arab Muslim world thinks. Not at all. The Arab Muslim world has not bought and paid for Congress like the American Israeli Political Action Committee has. Congress and the Biden administration are bought and paid for by the Israelis, period. In the objective world, if the United States is really concerned about, hey, we're not going to allow our money, our weapons, our resources to be used to carry out genocidal activities, and we're going to put a stop to it right now with Israel, it would stop tomorrow. They have zero interest. Biden has zero interest in doing that. King Abdullah would have been better off, you know, talking to the wall. At least he could get a good, you know, bounce back of his own voice. So, you know, this war is going to continue until it escalates out of control. Israel's been threatening to invade Lebanon. They've held off so far. I mean, they've stepped up bombing campaigns, but they've avoided putting their troops in there. However, they have moved their several of their brigades north and out of Gaza. They only have a few troops left in Gaza now. They continue to bomb and shell Gaza, but they've moved their combat force north, I think with the intent of trying to take on Hezbollah. And, you know, if they do it, I think Israel's going to learn a very, very, very hard lesson that that was a mistake. And they will take a beating. And it will only be in the aftermath of that beating that you may finally have an opening for real negotiations to bring an end to all this fighting.
How does Washington see this kind of policy on the part of the King of Jordan? Do they see him as a friend coming to them and talking with them, or they see him as a part of the Arab community that is trying to support the Arab world?
I think they see him as some compliant servant that they can order about to do what they want. That's U.S. approach. They don't respect him as an independent leader. They're not, you know, basically, you know, he's like their prison bitch. He can complain, but he's got to do what the United States wants done or else. So, you know, Abdullah's in a difficult situation. But you see it across the Middle East. Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, Tayyip Erdogan up in Turkey. There's a lot both of those countries could do to shut down Israel, but they're not doing it. Talk a good game, you know, But doing? Oh, no, no. Shut off the oil. Shut off the oil to Israel now. And go along with the boycott that the Houthis are trying to impose. That would really create... Israel's suffering, you know, enormously economically right now. It's only going to get worse. And if they get that kind of pressure, it could force Israel, Israel to change what it's doing. But at this point, you know, I think King Abdullah's words to Biden fell on not only deaf ears, but old demented ears. Mm-hmm.